Today, it's Edwin's Monday Evening Property Rant with Louis Christopher. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today I'm joined by Edwin and Louis Christopher. Hello, Louis. Good to see you first. How are you doing?
Good day, Martin. Doing okay, thank you. How are you?
Very good. It's great to have such a property guru on our channel. And, you know, work with you and Edwin here. It's looking pretty good.
Yeah, it should be a good session. I'm keen to talk the stats and look at the charts, and we can look at the forecasts that have come out recently and have a look at all the data. It should be entertaining.
Absolutely. And Edwin, are you on as well?
Look, I'm definitely on, Martin. Definitely on. I've got my boxing gloves on. I reckon you should have held this this discussion in the octagon personally. You got me and Louis, and we often go toe to toe on Twitter. So. I don't know what you were thinking, Martin. But let's let it rip.
Hey, Edwin, I recall you suggested it. So now it's good. I mean, it's what's really interesting here is that I think the collective minds of the three of us. I think we're going to come up with some really interesting points of view. And I think a really good place to start would be with Louis and his most recent report, because this report is very significant. It got a lot of press coverage when it came out. Would you like to give us the highlights, Louis?
Sure. Look, overall, each year as a background, we release our annual housing boom and bust report. It covers off actuals, it covers off forecasts, it covers the rental market, it gets down to the postcode level. We've been doing this now since 2010. It covers off what our forecasts were last year and how we landed with the previous year's forecasts. Of course, the headlines generally run through our major capital city scenarios, and I think that's the first thing I'll attempt to bring up now. So I'm going to bring up an Excel spreadsheet. Hopefully it will show the forecast. Here we go. How does that come through, gentlemen? Can you see
Perfect.
That?
Perfect. Yep, well, looks good.
Okay, so what we do each year, we usually run it either October or November, is do a scenario in terms of what we think may well be the four most likely scenarios, and then we hang our hat on one of them. But we also let our readers know that, look, hey, if we think the scenario has changed because of events, we usually let them know through our weekly newsletter that it has changed. Our base case scenario for next year is that we believe dwelling prices for the capital cities will rise somewhere between 5 to 9%. There are a number of assumptions we've run on that. Firstly, the cash rate remains unchanged at 0.1%. Second, QE expands. So as you may well be aware, we've got a quantitative easing program going on, which is effectively electronic money printing. And if I recall the number, the Reserve Bank of Australia set that at about $100 billion. We think that's going to expand out from $100 billion. Third point is that we think there may well be actually a third wave of coronavirus, but it should be contained very quickly. The ramifications for that for the housing market is we think there may well be some more lockdowns. And it leads into the fourth point. If we were to see additional lockdowns, we think the odds then increase of JobKeeper being expanded. And this is one of the crux of our forecast, is that we think that the housing crash that would have played out in 2020 was averted, and in part it was averted because of JobKeeper in terms of the amount of jobs it did save. Now, the government's on record as stating that JobKeeper is going to end in the March quarter. We think it's likely, given where unemployment still is at this point in time, that they will extend JobKeeper. And then the fourth point is that we'll see a progressive rollout of the COVID vaccine. It won't necessarily happen all in the first half of the year. It's going to progress out throughout the course of the year. So that's one of the assumptions. You'll see in our scenarios, we've got various views on that vaccine, how it could play out. For example, our scenario four is that something bad happens to the vaccine, it doesn't roll out properly at all, and they have to halt it, or As we state the time, it doesn't actually get properly released in 2021. Now, with our forecasts, generally speaking, they range from capital city. We're most bullish on Perth, where we think prices will rise between 8 to 12%, and we're more sanguine about Melbourne, where we think the market's going to be flat to maybe slightly rising. You'll see there that with our scenario two, this is the one where JobKeeper is phased out as planned at the end of the March quarter. Now, if that were to play out, then our forecasts are a little bit more flatlined, and indeed we actually would likely see price falls in Melbourne in our view. Now, the reason why a lot hinges on JobKeeper and the extension of JobKeeper and how it affects our main capital city, Sydney and Melbourne in particular, is based on our view that JobKeeper didn't just save a lot of jobs, it also saved a lot of businesses. But nevertheless, there have been a lot of businesses who have basically gone and are not coming back because of COVID. And those businesses in absolute numbers are predominantly in Sydney and Melbourne. So this is the reason why we're seeing on our forecast, what we have on our forecast, a more sort of flatline, weaker view of Sydney and Melbourne compared to the other cities.
One of the questions, of course, that I've got, because you're making a very important point, a lot of what's going to happen to house prices is going to be determined by how much extra government support is going to be tipped into the economy. That seems to be a fundamental point in your perspective. I agree with that, by the way. I think that's the most critical question.
Absolutely. It's the government at the moment saving the housing market.
Right.
And if you read carefully what they have been stating, either via the Reserve Bank of Australia, federal government itself, various state governments, it seems pretty clear that to us the housing market is front and centre for them. They really see the housing market as the driver for an economic recovery at this point in time anyway. And the thing is, they've got a lot of power to make that happen. So we need to consider exactly what they are intending on doing, what they've announced to date.
So are we also making the assumption, Louis, that is the government making the assumption that businesses are going to survive, or the majority of businesses are going to survive? Because anecdotally, we're getting a lot of chatter online through multiple sources. Yeah, there's in some cases anywhere between 100 to 400 people applying for jobs, even at this stage, even with the stimulus in place. So what's your take on the percentage of businesses that may survive post the stimulus in March next year, 2021, or how many are going to be standing? Because without businesses, there are no jobs, and regardless of how much stimulus you put into the economy, obviously the banks aren't going to lend to people that aren't employed or employable.
Yeah, look, I agree. While we do not know the exact numbers at this point in time in terms of how many businesses have gone down, what we do know, of course, is that in this country, once a business goes down, it's very hard to come back. It's very hard to open a new business. We're quite different from, say, the United States, where over in the US, they're more forgiving of bankruptcies. Well, they're less so in this country, as history has shown. So, I think this is going to be a real challenge for the government. And if they were to then phase out JobKeeper prematurely, this will cause potentially a second leg down in the economy if they do it prematurely. So we're watching very closely what the employment numbers do. With regarding the businesses, obviously, hospitality has been hit very hard. We can see that. Retail has been hit very hard. Anecdotally, our offices are in North Sydney, and if you know North Sydney, you'll know Walker Street and Miller Street. You walk down there, there's quite a few shops which have closed up. It reminds me very much of what I saw back in 1990 when I was leaving high school. Lots of businesses not coming back and closing up, and that is concerning. JobKeeper is helping those employees, and there's been help with businesses there as well. But I'm not so sure how many will be coming back.
Well, that's an interesting point, because my surveys are quite significant here, insofar that I survey small businesses, right? And just under one third of small businesses are currently saying they doubt whether they're going to be able to get through this without significant restructuring or potential closure. And it's concentrated down at the small end. I think larger companies are definitely coming back, and they're off JobKeeper compared with a few months ago. But actually, a number of smaller businesses have gone onto JobKeeper in the last month or so, you know, despite the tightening of the conditions. So I think this becomes a quite critical question, actually.
It is a critical question. There's no question about that, excuse the pun. I think, you know, going back to our forecast, it is very much a 2021, very contingent in terms of how much government expenditure we see. And that is the main summary of it. And you know, JobKeeper is an essential component of it. The RBA stated that JobKeeper essentially saved 700,000 jobs very recently. I've no doubt that is indeed the case.
And of course, ScoMo made the promise last election time that prices wouldn't drop under his reign, as it were. So he's holding true to that promise.
It's very interesting. He earlier this year, when we sort of mapped out potentially what could happen under a scenario of a second wave where the government is not able to actually commit, ScoMo at the time, or shortly after that time, made a forecast that the housing market wouldn't fall by some of those more negative scenarios. And we have one of those negative scenarios out there. We also said, look, hey, if there wasn't a second wave and there was lots of stimulus, we wouldn't see that type of more negative scenario play out. And as it's turned out, we did have a second wave. It was contained reasonably well, except for Victoria. But we had a lot of stimulus come through. JobKeeper was extended, as well as some of the businesses' PAYG relief as well that was running through that hasn't received as much media attention.
Yeah, and very interesting, of course, with those scenarios, because they do vary by different locations, as perhaps you might expect. But I'm also interested in the split between units and houses, because I think there's something really important going on there. But what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, so our forecasts are generally for all dwellings. In our report, we've made it pretty clear that we've got more of a positive outlook for houses over units. We are definitely more bearish on the unit market, particularly Sydney, Melbourne, but also the Brisbane CBD unit market isn't looking that flash hot right now. Neither is the Adelaide unit market, and we can run through some of those charts if you want to run through that in terms of the reasons why we see that. But, you know, just looking at the Sydney unit market, we've seen some pretty steep falls in rents. We have seen some falls in prices as well. And it's really interesting in terms of the dynamics playing out there, predominantly caused by COVID, of course. It's been part of this great shift away from the inner city living towards outer regional living and outer suburban living, and people looking for larger properties to live and work in. Now, of course, as we know, many people are working from home these days, and that's what I'm doing right now. So that has created a fundamental movement in the unit market of our capital cities this year. The question remains, will there be a reversal once we get past COVID? Will people start coming back into the CBD areas, into the inner city areas, once they feel like it's safe to enter the waters, as it were?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I would add, sorry, I wouldn't let you come in a second. I'd also add that my surveys are highlighting something really interesting about the unit sector and the number of property investors with units who are intending to sell over the next 6 to 9 months. The number is actually increasing quite quickly in the surveys, and that's because rentals are being compressed. And the fact of the matter is there's no capital growth in many of these unit scenarios, particularly the high rise in the suburban, inner areas, say North Ryde and closer in, if I take Sydney examples. So it looks to me as though we're going to have a very significant oversupply of units coming on stream. Which
I would add to that that look, I think the oversupply has been with us. It's there, and it's there as a result of a number of factors. Firstly, of course, the international border being closed. We were due to have this year some 240,000 people turn up to our shores. They didn't turn up. Not there. Where do they normally go? Where do they normally go to Sydney and Melbourne? Generally speaking, they will, you know, they'll spread out, but they also will look at the inner city areas and look at units, of course. Now, I thought as part of this conversation, if you don't mind, I might start sharing something else with you, if that's okay, and that is having a look at some of these unit rental listings in the particular area. So just bear with me one moment.
Whilst you're getting that, chart? Or that data, if you say that the government is looking at saving the residential the property market, but I would have thought that it would be more keen on saving the commercial space as well, given the fact that commercial space creates more employment than the residential arena. What are your thoughts on that?
When I consider the lending side of the equation there, firstly, the banks have been more keen historically to say the residential over commercial. So we go back to, for example, the GFC of 2008, when we were having this real restriction on lending. The banks effectively turned off lending towards commercial from what we understood, but kept the taps open for residential. And that's been their tendency. There is certainly a lot of, from what I can see in the office market, a fair bit of blood on the street there in terms of landlords trying to lease their office space. And there could be more of a structural shift now, given the fact that lots more people are working from home. Do tenants need the amount of office space that they've historically required? I think we would all agree they don't.
Yeah, but also given the fact that over the last 10 years or, you know, 10, 12 years, we've seen a huge shift in superannuation funds going to self-managed super funds and also fund managers acquiring, volumes or, huge amounts of commercial space. Now, if they're going to be left vacant or dormant and they're going to drop, unless it's blue chip commercial space, that's going to drop. That's going to be a huge blow to the, to the economy, to the retirees, given the fact that we're an aging population. So I think that's something that the government hasn't really, may not have really considered and hasn't really mapped it out, all in the guise of trying to save the residential arena where there's still a lot to play out.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen anything really announced significantly on the commercial front. I could be wrong on that, but I haven't seen that much at all, other than tenancy moratoriums, of course, for those tenants who've been affected by coronavirus. Just like the residential market, commercial tenants were able to request a moratorium if they were able to prove they've been negatively affected by COVID. So that's certainly been a bearing. And then when I also consider, it's just offhand, but the most recent stamp duty changes announced by the New South Wales state government, there really wasn't that much there on the commercial side at all in terms of relief or incentive. It was all on the residential side.
Yeah, which is particularly, it's going to be what I would consider a left hook knockout to a lot of these other stimulus that's taking place, because a lot of businesses and a lot of business owners and a lot of investment is placed on the commercial space. And if as I don't doubt what you're saying. I'm pretty taking, I appreciate your data and all the information that you and Martin have. I think that's something that the government is really not considering and not protecting themselves that well. It's going to be one of those left hook blows that's going to really knock them for a six.
Well, unfortunately, on the commercial side, it's really hard to monitor what's going on there. We don't cover commercial property data. It's the data is more difficult to basically strip down, analyze. It's very difficult. But yeah, look, I hear where you're coming from. It is definitely a factor in all this. There'll be some long-term ramifications on the commercial side. And I certainly have no intentions of going by a commercial property anytime soon, put it that way.
I think all of us can say amen to that.
Okay, let's go back to the weekly rent listings. So you've got that slide up at the moment. So let's
see. You can see that. Yeah. This is something I wanted to point out. So this is for the Sydney CBD. Now, something that we've done early this year, which we announced on Twitter, is that, okay, I'm sure your gentlemen will be aware of our rental vacancy rates. Mm. Through feedback, we decided we should release a weekly rental listings index, which we've got down to every postcode. And as you can see here, we can split it by units versus houses, which is a little bit more difficult for us to do it with our vacancy rates. I can go into that a little bit later on, or if you've got a question on that, happy to answer. But this chart here is for postcode 2000. So in the Sydney CBD, and the light blue is units and the dark blue is houses. There hardly any houses, as you would expect. We would classify semi as a house, of course. So you can see just the absolute launch of listings, which happened effectively from about March, where it climbed from about, you know, just under 500 rental listings all the way up to 1,250 in the CBD. Now, just one thing I'd like to point out to you, we are actually starting to see a bit of a reversal now. So rental listings in the CBD are starting to come back a bit. They've come back to the highs that we were experiencing mid last year. Still very elevated, of course. That still represents an elevated vacancy rate where rents would be falling. But there does seem to be a bit of a reversal. So I'm just starting to wonder whether we're starting to see some people come back into the CBD, maybe take advantage of the big rental falls which have happened. And the rental falls have been pretty significant. So if I look at basically the unit market for the same postcode, you can see here for two bedroom units just before coronavirus really hit back in March, they were renting about $987 a week. And on our listing numbers, that number's come down to $700 a week. So big falls. And it wasn't just the Sydney area, of course. If I go to Melbourne, we'll see probably a similar situation here too. Yeah, really big falls and rents that have been recorded in Melbourne. And if we look at the weekly rental listings for postcode 3000, that is by days on market. I'll put it to units to make it an easier read. You can still see the numbers are still very elevated. It hasn't been a reversal yet in the numbers for Melbourne.
That's very interesting, Louis.
Very, very interesting results there.
That is really, really interesting, because one of the things I measure is stress, including investor stress, right? And investor stress is highest in, guess where, 3,000, followed by 2,000. Right, so which sort of correlates with very high vacancy rates and potentially with the fact that there is lots of stuff around. And the interesting question is whether that slide down in Sydney is because people are actually successfully now renting property, or whether they're actually pulled it off the market perhaps to sell it or to do something else with it. Difficult to tell. But we certainly know that both in 2000 and 3000, international visitors and international students were the prime users of precisely that accommodation set, which is no longer required.
Spot on. As mentioned, it goes to my point. You know, are we going to see people starting to come back? And just keep in mind those rental falls, which are huge. Mm. And quite frankly, you wouldn't want to be a property owner, a landlord experiencing that right now, and of course servicing a mortgage in that area, nasty times. Of course, the flip side to that is that we've seen very sharp and plummeting declines in vacancy rates in the outer urban regions. And I really wanted to show you the contrast, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'll just come back to here. Here we go. I'm just going to bring up vacancy rates by region and bring up the Blue Mountains, because that is really the contrast. Okay. Now you can see here, of course, the area is more dominated by houses versus units, but just the almost the inverse of what we're seeing in the CBD. And it really, you know, look, hey, got to be careful how you put causation into effect, but I think it is evidence, definitely, of people moving out from the CBD and looking to get away from everybody else.
And that's the demographic shift that we're experiencing. And as Martin and I have been talking for months now, the dust is still yet to settle. But obviously with this, with business owners and companies facilitating their workers to work from home, whether it be 2 days or 3 days or choice of however many days they like to work from home, they want a lot of space, and there's that psychological fear that they don't want to be caught up in a high rise development in Parramatta and paying $700 a week, in a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment in Parramatta when they can go to the mountains and pay, at the moment, pay $550 a week for a 3 bedroom house with a bit of land and they can breathe. So it's all that uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen, as you say, Louis. Is there going to be a third wave? Is there going to be a second wave in Sydney, or a third wave, or what other diseases are going to be unleashed on the population post 2020? So all these uncertainties obviously created all these shifts, which is rather interesting. And I think you've captured it well. Mm. A lot of towns that we look for property for clients for in. Some towns they've got 30, 40 groups of people attending open for inspections for rentals, and they're getting offers on the day of 10, 15, 20% more than what's being advertised just to get the property.
Well, I think, that's interesting you'd say that, having all these people coming at and the falls and listings for the outer regional areas, it kind of suggests to us, and we've been saying this a little bit, that the regional rural areas haven't really been ready for this sudden surge in demand. And they had little capacity to take on, a town, say, with 10,000 people, suddenly having, say, 1,000 people turn up, they don't have the spare accommodation for it. And I suspect potentially it's been at the point where people have been turned away. They haven't been able to find the accommodation, looking at other towns, looking further afield. I mean, we've been recording falls in rental vacancy rates for nearly every regional township in Australia. It's something I've never seen before. But the question does hold there. I mean, if the regional townships are not able to respond to all that demand quickly, could we see people come back? They just cannot find a property they want. Will I come back to the cities again? And what are the long-term solutions that we should see in our regional townships? I mean, I think it's an important thing we do grow our regional townships over long term.
Yeah, look, I think there are two factors that are obviously going to influence the transition back to the migration back to the city. One is obviously I've got a number of clients and associates that have got clients that are currently renting in three-bedroom apartments in the 2000 postcode region. They were renting for 12 months ago for $1,450 a week up to $1,750 a week. Now they've just signed re-signed leases for one at $800 a week and another one at $875 a week. So that's of interest. So then becomes an interesting, as you say, an interesting dilemma to be in is do we go back into the city, pay almost 50% what we were paying 12 months ago, and people can secure 2 and 3 year leases under the current Residential Tenancies Act. without going to, without getting special conditions put in the residential tenancy agreements, if they want to secure for longer than that. So I think that's what people are doing, and that's the advice that I've been giving people. They say, look, you can lease a property for 2-3 years. There's nothing to say that you can't. If you want to lease it for more, then you just get special dispensation from the tribunal to do so. And the other thing, Louis, is obviously, as we know, is the you've spoken about is the vaccine. So when you've got these two factors, hugely reduced rent and the vaccine, well, people are going to feel a lot more safe and secure to move back into the more densely populated areas, and that's going to give them that peace of mind. And let's face it, if you're trying to rent a 3-bedroom home in the Blue Mountains now for $550 a week, or in some cases $600 a week now, when you can now go back and secure a 2-bedroom apartment, waterfront apartment in a 2000 postcode for the same amount, some couples are going to make the choice of going back to the city because the vaccine's just around the corner.
Yeah, that's how we're thinking. As mentioned, there seems to be some evidence of a part reversal now happening, at least in Sydney. Whether it's going to, I think it's unlikely though, it's going to be a full reversal while the international borders remain closed. And I think, from what I understand through, people I speak with on the ground, many people have actually used coronavirus as a catalyst for a lifestyle change.
That's
great. And so, yeah, sure, there were some people who literally wanted to leave town because they were scared of picking up the virus. But many people, like, they had this on their agenda for some time now, and they've used this as a catalyst. And, of course, with the improvements in technology, the ability for employers to allow their employees to work from home, long may it continue, there'll be people not coming back. They'll make it work in the regions for sure.
So then that's then is the $64 million question then, Louis, is the how severe is going to be the apartment downfall going to be?
Well, I, on our numbers, we think it's going to keep going until next year. But I don't think we can rule out when the international borders do open. This is one of the theories we've got here, is that if you take the view that the government is going to throw the kitchen sink at the housing market, what's to stop them from really trying to ramp up migration once again? And I think that's on the cards. It doesn't mean it will happen, but I think it's one of those ones where you've got to consider the probabilities. If their view of the world is weak, we must save the housing market. Housing market's now front and center of the economy.
At 8%, I would say that at 8% unemployment rate, I would say that the Australian population may pallet a huge increase in migration. But at closer to 15%, I think you'll have a revolution, and you'll have people picketing at the international airport against the government.
It'll be very interesting to see how it plays, and it'll be very interesting to see how Labor would stand on that front, because they've, generally speaking, many on the Labor side have been pro-migration, pro-Big Australia. So my money is on that they may well do this, but they may not make any grand announcement.
Yeah, look, I don't think you could hide, 10 planes coming, international flights coming in a day in, at Kingsford Smith Airport. I don't think you could hide that. You might be able to hide one coming in at 12 o'clock at midnight or something like that, but not 10 coming in every day with migrants. And then the question is who's got the money to come over? It's a conundrum for sure. It's a can of worms for sure. And it's the one thing I think we can agree on definitely is that 2021 is going to be one interesting year for property, particularly for apartments.
Mm. Well, the budget estimates are that migration, we're going to have net migration outflow for next year, and the government's forecasting that for 2022. So far that they've been very conservative on their estimates there. And if their estimates do play out, then it's going to be a negative for the unit market for sure.
But what's really fascinating is what we're actually all saying is that the future of the property market is more determined by government policy, and that policy is direct stimulus and migration policy than almost anything else.
Yeah, I believe so. I think there's been evidence, increasing evidence of government intervention in the housing market. Really, I can take it at least back to the start of my professional career in residential real estate analysis back to 2001 when they brought in the first home owners grant scheme back then. They've been more and more evolved in the market. Of course, you've got a Prime Minister that came originally from the Property Council of Australia, so I can tell you which side he sits on. they've been more and more involved. And look, for me, I'm more of a free market guy. I think markets should be allowed to rise and they should be allowed to fall. More government intervention is not necessarily a great thing. But here we are, we've got it, and we're at the point now where, hey, they're doing electronic money printing. I mean, who would have thought? It's crazy stuff, really.
Well, and the point is they can go on doing that for quite some time, which is, you know, one of the reasons why everybody's now changing their view on property. Now, we should just say, we're not going to be able to go into all of your insights tonight, but there is this boom and bust report, which you've just produced, and I do recommend that people go buy it. It's really, really powerful report. And, of course, your website is also available and has massive amounts of information at a postcode level. It is the one I keep recommending to people whenever I talk to anybody about property, because I believe that the data that you have and that your approach is much more powerful than many of the others. But it takes us to a really interesting conversation about data, the sources of property data, and essentially what's going in Australia. And I think we should move the conversation on, if I may, to specifically explore two questions. The first is your data flows. Can you just explain a little bit about where they come from and how you process the information and get to what you get to? And then secondly, I know Edwin's got some very specific points that he wants to discuss with you with regard to some of the data issues that he sees.
Sure thing. Our data comes from multiple sources. So one of the primary sources, of course, is the value of general data. That's pretty critical to actually get. We have license agreements with a number of state governments to get access to that data, and we use that data. Of course, that data can be very messy. It can be laggy. And so it's important to get other sources of data. And one of the main sources of data for more of our leading indicators, which, you know, we've covered some of them today, is, of course, the listings data, as well as the agent-reported sold records. So we monitor the major listing sites who shall remain nameless, because one of them's already sent me a legal letter some time ago. But nevertheless, we can still monitor, and that's what we do. And we've been monitoring those major listing sites through now coming up to about 10 years. We do that in a more consistent way. We regard that data as quite important in terms of providing a story about what's going on in the here and now versus the value of general data, which, as mentioned before, can be quite laggy indeed.
Yes, of course, the value of general data can be very laggy, as you say, and also has some quite funny stuff in it. If you look at it, there are some old transactions and some weird values, and you've got a little bit of filtering out to be able to get the real data. Well, one of the things I wanted to go on.
Oh, I was about to say, look, yeah, it's part of the trick of the trade is, it's being able to properly filter that data out, knowing the difference when a property's got, say, a $15 million price tag when it should be $1.5 million or $150,000.
Exactly, yes. But one of the interesting observations is that you started relatively recently reporting auction clearance rate data. Yes. And your method comes up with a number that is substantially lower than many of the other portals as they report. And I just wanted to explore that a little bit, because I think this is a really important point, because, you know, the auction clearance rates have been, frankly, making the news for, I think, all the wrong reasons for quite some time. So just take us through some of your thinking there and how you've actually got to the sorts of rates that you get to.
I will do that. I'll take you through that. And if you like, I can give you a bit of a bigger background behind my full experience and terms of reporting on auction clearance rates, which really goes back to 2001. So yes, the clearance rates SQN research puts together now, basically the key data set we're doing to do this is, of course, we're monitoring all the listing advertisements. Now, one of the things we are doing differently, and you will be aware, is that we are reporting a little bit later than, say, on the Saturday, where we generally report on the Tuesday afternoons what has happened. What's going on is that when agents make a sale, or if they don't make a sale, they adjust their advertisement that they have online to state what has actually happened. So if they haven't actually sold the property at auction, they'll re-advertise the property with new inspection times or an asking price. They'll take off the word auction. And they generally do that within the first couple of business working days after the auction. We are able to monitor those changes in the ads. Of course, we're picking up the listings themselves. So when a property is advertised as auction, normally there is a date and a time, and naturally an address. And if it does have those factors, then we put that into our up and coming schedule of auctions. So through doing that, we have been reporting significantly lower clearance rates than some of our peers. So at the moment, we've got Sydney with an auction clearance rate just over, nudging over 60% now. Melbourne's been in the low 50s. The numbers actually got down to the low 40s. And if you like, I'll share a screen once again on this. Let's bring this up. I had this all ready to roll. What's happened to it? Here we go. All right. Can you see that?
Yep.
Okay. So this is Sydney's auction clearance rate. And you'll see I've run this back to the beginning of the year. And we were recording auction clearance rates just under 70% for Sydney. We regard at the time the market prior to coronavirus was starting to pick up pace. And then you can see the big fall in the clearance rate, where we recorded clearance rates below 30%. Volumes also fell away. Also note there was a mad scramble of sellers trying to get out before coronavirus fully hit. I think a few weeks out from the lockdowns, there was real fear lockdowns were coming, and sure enough, they came. And then we've had a bit of a pickup in terms of volumes and the clearance rate. But of course, our peers have got clearance rates now hovering around in the mid-70s. Now, if the market was with a clearance rate, if we were getting mid-70s in the clearance rate and high 70s in the clearance rates, you'd be looking at double-digit capital growth per annum happening right now, and I'm not so sure whether that's really happening. But I'm also well aware of how they do their reporting, and I've commented about this for many years now, that the way their method of reporting is very questionable indeed. So how they do it, of course, is they try to get as many auctions reported in by ringing up real estate agents, sending emails out, getting agents to fill in databases of their auction results on the day. And as I've clearly communicated over a number of years now, they're not getting all the auction results. We believe we are getting all the results, or nearly all the results, through the monitoring of the changes of those ads. And sure enough, we're recording a clearance rate a lot lower than them. The issue is that with unreported auctions, which Domain at the moment, they generally have an unreported rate running in the mid to high 20s. Sometimes it's in the 30 percentile mark. In other words, they're missing 30% of auctions. Is that they will generally be auctions where there's been a failed campaign. The property didn't sell on the day. So that's half the issue. But there's another issue which I want to share with you, because, which goes back to my history, but it's something else I wanted to share with you, which I also put up on Twitter. And that is, it's not just a matter of reporting. Can you see this Excel file?
Yep.
All right, so back in June, I did a little bit of an audit of Domain's results versus ours. You'll see there on the left, column A is the addresses, column B, the result that Domain reported, and then what we knew about that actual particular result. And The truth was is that there was a whole bunch of properties which shouldn't have been recorded as sold because they were either previously recorded as sold, like they were actually scheduled on an earlier date, and they were just shoved into the present weekend's results. Some of them were being re-advertised as under offer, and I guess under our ruling, we regard an under offer not actually a sale under auction conditions. Maybe everyone might agree or disagree with me on that point, but that's the rule we have for our auctions. And then a whole bunch of down here sold after auctions. So they didn't sell under the hammer, they sold after the auction. Now, the issue with that, of course, is domain's own methodology states it don't include those. But here they are, they were included, sold after auction. So, yeah, there's issues. There's issues in reporting in terms of unreported. There's some issues in terms of previous results going into present day results, which we think is wrong.
Right, and that's very significant, isn't it? Because people are making decisions based on what the media are reporting about auction clearance rates, for example. And I guess
The media picks up on the preliminary clearance rate. Now, Domain does a revision, and as I understood, standard CoreLogic does a revision as well, and they always get revised downwards, always. You never see a revision upwards.
No. Yeah. I find it interesting, Louis, the fact that your actual data pool or data your data pool and your interpretation of the Sydney in the Sydney region is actually broader or wider than CoreLogic and also Domain's, and yet you come up with a lower percentile than Domain and CoreLogic. So in itself, I would have thought, I would have expected at a higher percentile coming up on under your data set because you're capturing a lot more. And what I feel in your Sydney region, in the region that you capture under your data pool, is there's a lot more desirable property in the outskirts of Sydney than there is closer to the city, one would think. So more attractive in terms of price points, more attractive in terms of changing lifestyle, the whole bit. So I find that very interesting. So it's rather intriguing and rather perplexing how widespread the Domain and CoreLogic data is, or how much do they really want to tell the general public?
I'll give you a bit of background behind this. You might not be aware of this, but when I started my professional career off in residential real estate analysis, as mentioned, it was about 2001. I was working with a company called Australian Property Monitors, which is now, of course, completely owned by Domain. You barely see the name out there now. And I was responsible for the auction collections team. Now, one of the key factors there was in terms of our commitment to auction reporting was that we were under contract with Fairfax to deliver 90% of the results on the day. We had to. This was before Fairfax owned APM outright. They had some ownership, but not outright. And so there were commercial contracts there. And this, of course, was back at the time of the Rivers of Gold, all Fairfax's print advertising. And we had to report 90% on the day at least. And so back then, when you look at the auction stats between, say, 2000 through to 2008, 2009, a good market was when you'd see auction clearance rates basically run above 60%, really. But it didn't really require it to be at 80 or 90% is what they report now. A bad market was when you started seeing the clearance rate trend down and would get down to, say, the 50s or the 40s. I guess the point I'm trying to say now, it just seems as though with their clearance rates, they're regarding a sort of a normal market now as like in the 70s. But previously, getting 70% or plus was a very, very strong market.
Yeah, that's good. And at that time, I mean, I do know that you worked for Australian Property Monitors. Yeah, I think you did 6 or 7 years there. You were in charge of that. And a lot of the information, a lot of the data that was given out was very, very specific, was very what I would consider, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would consider to be very strong. If 1 was dodgy data and 10 was great data, it was up in the 8s and 9s at that time. But now it's questionable whether we even get past number 3 with regards to domain and core logic.
Well, look, I don't know what's going on in there. I know they've still got an option team, but I know that those type of contracts which, had specific clauses in there probably are no longer in existence, given the fact that they completely own the business now. I do raise questions having a listings business running a research company. I think there needs to be more separation between the two.
I had contacts. I had contacts working alongside the good old Doc when he was heading the main team there. And I can tell you now, the data that I got from my insiders was totally different to the data that was released by the Doc at the time. So, I don't dispute anything that you say. I've seen the data deteriorate over the years, and I've also seen the increase of the industry pushing for auction sales and the push more to line the selling agents' pockets than to do any favors to the actual property owner. So I mean that's another argument, and that in itself created a false sense of security as well with the data that had to be shown, because a lot of from about 2008, 2005, 2006, there was a major push for auctions for people to sell by way of auction, because obviously the print media got more of a drink with the marketing, the property portals that we helped build to these monsters that they are now, which are about to take over and chew up the industry and spit it out. We helped them build this, and all on the backs and on the promotion of many of the pundits that are on Twitter continue to push for auctions and make sensational headlines on Sydney Morning Herald how they achieved, the agents that they represented of the day achieved $500,000 above reserve. I mean, it's farcical to see the bullshit that's put out. I'm allowed to say bullshit, by the way, Lou, because Martin says bullshit on the program, so I'm allowed to say bullshit. You can say bullshit as well if you want. It's really farcical, the amount of BS that's put out there by way of auction clearance rates, and we make such a big deal out of it.
Yeah, look, from an analyst perspective, I it's definitely still worthwhile looking at, because you're getting results here and now. So it's very timely on that front, but you just got to be careful you don't sacrifice timeliness. You sacrifice accuracy for timeliness, and that's clearly been going on, not just with auction results, but other.
So on that note, with data, Louis, you've got what would you consider to be? Let's shift from auction clearance rates to the hedonic daily imputation or hedonic daily index. From your experience, your knowledge, and expertise in the industry, what would you say is the lag in time with CoreLogic's data that's put out as a daily index?
Yeah, look, I have certainly been a public critic of their daily index, mainly by virtue of the fact that I'm well aware of the lags with the data, and so it's. That they've promoted that index as saying, all right, well, we know what the market's doing today based on prices. And the truth is that, let's consider New South Wales, the valuer general, let's just keep in mind, the valuer general doesn't actually get the record or record the record or send it on to data publishers like ourselves until the record, the property has been settled.
Exactly. Which I had a debate with Tim Lawless about 3 years ago on Twitter, and he's of the impression of the belief that you know, they're 60 to 70 days is the worst case scenario. I want to think that 72 days in lag in the data is the best case scenario, but you know, it's not, that's, you know, what's 10 days between friends. Look, it's interesting because you do bring out a point in that where you get your data from, and you're certainly aware of the fact, and that's what I just wanted to highlight, is the fact that you're an industry specialist. You know, and you don't put forth these daily imputations, daily indexes, to which really hides what's really going on in the background. And that, no different to the auction clearance rates, that gives a false sense of perception. And then the other thing is because it's so lagged, I mean, you know, the data is so lagged that I make it a point to send Tim and CoreLogic weekly updates of how they haven't updated that back end. It's ludicrous what goes on out there.
Yes. Well, their methodology, if you read their methodology, they used to have a methodology paper out there. I'm not so sure whether they've got it there on the daily index now. But part of how they were putting together was effectively it was the daily price index is actually an estimate of their current valuations of all properties. So they would update the valuations, and whatever the collective valuations would say for the day was what was changing the unit price. And of course, as we know, valuations are based on comparable sales. Those comparable sales, of course, you know, if you base it on, say, settlement data, may well have happened months ago. So, yeah, we had a lot of issues with it. To be fair to them, they did try to fix their index up now after denying that there were problems. In 2016, they changed their methodology, and I think they did make some improvements. Keep in mind that they tried to make that methodology change on the quiet, and the RBA actually caught them out doing it and made the front page of the papers. You know, in all this business, character is important, reputation is important, and I think that they've lost points big time on their daily index. You know, I potentially long term, you might be able to pick up on a trend, but these daily movements, look, property is just so unique. Every property is, it's not like the share market. Every property out there is unique to each other. And it's not like a standardized share like BHP shares. They're all different. And you know, that's part of the challenge in doing all this is attempting to take that into account. They say they may well do it through their hedonics, but I know the data they're getting, and there's not enough data to do an hedonic index properly. It just simply isn't there. Anyway, right. I could rant on about this for a while, but yeah, the daily index is one of my bugbears, put it that way.
Now, look, and it is one of mine too, but maybe you can join me on a Friday. I usually send Tim and CoreLogic, where they haven't updated the back end. Maybe you can pick out a few as well yourself from your part of town. I mainly do it from the North Shore of late, where the data can be anywhere between 20 to 35% apart from the actual sale price that was achieved a few weeks prior to when I send it to them to what their daily index says on the back end. But on that, talking about the industry and being part of the industry, you know, we get these articles of late, obviously the one that you would have seen in the Sydney Morning Herald with the auctioneer in on point was saying that, you know, three properties or so got sold for $500,000 above the reserve. Well, you know, that for me as a real estate agent, as a licensed real estate agent, raises a lot of questions. The first one is did the agent know the true value of the property when they took it to market in the first place, or did they underquote? But outside of those two, you've got this. The manipulation of the actual advertised price or the actual guided price prior to the auction, and then you've got these huge jumps in sale prices, which then they, you know, obviously the agents beat their chest, the selling agents beat their chest and say, what a wonderful job we did. And then auctioneers get quoted on the Sydney Morning Herald to say that what a magnificent time it is in the property market. One would think, therefore, that in that particular area or those particular areas or the market in general has gone up anywhere between 25 to 27%, when in actual fact, the starting point was misguided, was flawed, was and was falsely stated. I mean, what are your thoughts on how complicit the industry itself? And when I say, I mean, that's talking about myself, you know, in terms of the industry, in terms of selling agents, or the real estate industry itself has been in producing this, whether it be false hope or otherwise, when agents and agencies don't promote the true values or don't guide or don't give the proper guides in the first place.
Okay, well, all fair comments there. I mean, first up, we are well aware that the reserve, of course, is not a public number. Right, so that's something that's kept private between the agent and the owner. So who knows what the real reserve was? That's always one thing that runs through my mind. What was the real reserve? Second to that, yeah, I mean, if a reserve is artificially lower, the agent, have they done their job? They should be well aware of what it is. Now, that said, though, it's probably fair to say that if you were to see a turning point in the market where the market's suddenly getting stronger, you know, and sometimes the market can flip very quickly, going from weakness to strength, that potentially some sellers would be caught out like that, and indeed agents. And as mentioned before, every property is unique, so sometimes it is hard to get the reserve right, particularly if we're talking about more affluent real estate. But nevertheless, we do see it all too often, and the agents and the papers or the media loves reporting that something's gone over reserve by X amount of dollars. It may not mean anything at all, really. And certainly from an analyst point of view, I don't take any of that into account.
Yeah, look, and I appreciate your sincerity in that. That's good. The problem is overall, from your analyst point of view, from my industry point of view, from Martin's point of view, from an economic point of view, a lot of the data that is out there is flawed, is somewhat corrupt, and is very, very deceiving. And which leads me to my next question, and that is, should the regulators and the industry, the authorities in the industry, within the industry, and I'm not talking about the Real Estate Institute of New South Wales because they're a toothless tiger, and I'm talking about the Fair Trade in New South Wales, and government authorities, should they do more about the controls of data or what is published than what they're doing already? Can you see any changes there, or we're not going to have any changes? It's, you know, Edwin, shut your face and get on to the next question.
Sort of no, thing. No. It's a good question. I think there needs to be regulation. I also think that there needs to be multiple parties out there to gain a consensus. If the government was the sole provider of data, I'd be concerned about that. Obviously, I've got a conflict there because I'm a data provider. But from a pure buyer's perspective, I'd want to see competition out there. I think the ABS and moving away from doing their own relationships with the valuer general was a mistake. And we were very disappointed with how the ABS went about out there trying to source of data, a private data provider. We weren't even given an option to go for that job. But that's another story for another day. But there does need to be regulation, but I think there also needs to be competition, and it would be dangerous just to have one encompassing body cover it all. I don't think that should occur. But yeah, there needs to be oversight. There needs to be a body. I mean, let's consider the Australian Securities and Investment Commission. They do not cover property. We've got a license of the Australian Securities and Investment Commission through our other work we do on funds. But, you know, and there is a lot of regulation there. It's actually very difficult for a bad person to do something wrong there. You will get caught. It would be good to see that type of regulation on reporting. Real estate, of course, is usually for most people that their largest asset they'll ever hold. Yet, you know, it's the regulation around it is definitely lacking, and certainly when it comes to reporting, there needs to be more regulation there. I'm surprised I haven't seen it in my career to date.
Yeah, which is rather sad, which also obviously leads me to the last question, and that is this is more of a personal observation, Lou, in what I've seen. Like I said, I know your history, where you come from, what you've done, and you've got great insights into the portals, more than what I will ever have. I do recall when, from the beginnings of Domain and REA and how we in the industry basically helped build these beasts that now rule the industry and charge vendors and agencies an arm and a leg to advertise properties on. But from a personal observation, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, Louise, has the industry created a beast, or has the industry created two beasts that is about to devour the industry? And my background in this for asking this question is the fact that there was a meeting held offshore with particular heads, and one of the main topics was the fact that in that particular time, the income revenue for advertising, for agencies advertising on across both portals, was something like collective annual revenue of $2.4 billion. Now, that seems like a lot of money, but when you compare that, the $2.4 billion collective revenue across Domain and REA, to the commissions, the earned revenue by real estate agents and agencies across Australia was more like $15 billion. Obviously, the 2.4 to 15, it starts putting a bit of thought into the minds of the heads of these organizations. And I put out approximately 3-4 years ago, I said within 5 years, we will see Domain and real estate become the best way for me to put it right now is see it become a purple bricks on steroids, because their belief is that whilst agents use Domain and real estate to advertise for property, and whilst buyers look at Domain and real estate to search for property, well, really, why should the agents earn the $15 billion, and we only earn 2.4? So could you see these two portals moving more into a fee-for-service arrangement, like purple bricks on steroid arrangement, over the next couple of years perhaps?
Well, it is a lot of money for them to chase, isn't it? And as public companies, they've got a mandate, they must keep growing their earnings.
Exactly my point. It is the $15 billion in revenue that agents make is very tempting when you look at the 2.4 on the other side of the fence.
Well, if they did it, though, that may well be the last straw for agents, though, I suspect. Mind you, the question is, if they did it, how could agents respond to that? Where would they list?
That's a good question, and I can quickly answer that by saying the fact that there's 53,000 real estate agents in New South Wales, registered in New South Wales, of which about 27,000 are selling agents. Mm-hmm. The question is, to date, I think Tarek's tallied it up to about 1,200 transactions a week. Mm-hmm. A lot of selling agents aren't getting fed, Louis, and if you break it all down across the board, Sydney real estate agents, selling agents, are only earning something like the equivalent of $246 a week if you break it all down to averages.
Mm-hmm. Fair call. Cool. Look, they certainly could make that move. And they've got to keep earning revenues somehow, and they can only tap the agents so far. Mind you, they do keep tapping, increasing the advertising premiums that they charge. I mean, you'll be in a better position to tell us what general premiums they charge now compared to back in say, you know, when they started off back in the late 90s.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm assuming it's a world of difference.
Yeah, I think it was something like $75 a month, and we thought that was I thought that was very high for a subscription. And now we're paying something like $1,500 per property for 30 days, in some on average in some suburbs. Some suburbs could run up to $2,500 for a premier listing.
Well, agents pass it on to the sellers. You know, I don't know if they earn a small premium out of that or not, but yeah, I mean, this is all passed on, but how long can you keep passing it on?
Yeah, they look, that's another subject for vendor paid advertising, another one of my sacred cows, but I won't go into too much into that, but I can tell you now the commissions have gone down because of the vendor paid advertising is what gives a lot of agencies and agents the ongoing weekly or monthly revenue to keep the offices open as opposed to commissions, because it could take a long time to sell a property. The transactions on a weekly basis in terms of sales, actual sales on auction campaigns, as you know, is averaging about 360 at the moment. Which is not a lot when you start thinking that there's 27,000 selling agents, or let's say 15,000 selling agents in Sydney alone. So a lot of agents are not getting fed. It's a long time in between drinks. Mm-hmm. So this Purple Bricks model, Purple Bricks on steroids model, would suit the industry a lot more if it's a fee for service. Given the fact that a lot of the money goes into marketing, into advertising, because another thing that's happened, particularly in the last 5 years, a lot of people don't know, but there's a lot of agencies, and you may be aware, in the Lower North Shore in the eastern suburbs that are selling property at 0.5%, as long as you pay vendor paid advertising up front, because that's what keeps the engine going. That's what keeps the vehicle going, not the actual sale. I know of certain agents in the Lower North Shore that have agencies that I've known them for many years that have told me that the competition are actually selling property for free just to get a signboard up on the road. On top, all they get is the vendor paid advertising. But we know that's jacked up anyway, which is what keeps the petrol in the tank.
Yeah, no, I've definitely have been noticing there's been increased competition for agents' commission rates. That's been going on a bit more. But there is that backhander, and they do need to be paid. Many agents offer a good service, and sure, we can bag out the clearance rates, but yeah, there's many good people in the industry as well who try and do the right thing.
I have to say, Edwin, I think we're probably at the end of our recording time here, because we're going to get this out today. But look, I just want to say to both of you, and specifically to Louis, thank you so much for your time tonight. I think the insights that you've shared with the audience here have been remarkable, insofar that you've been very honest and straightforward about the data and how it's presented, the messages that are there, which are not necessarily those that are being reported so much in the mainstream, but nevertheless are really, really important. And Louis, just to be clear, if people want to get more information or your latest report, how do they go about it?
Oh, they just come to our website, sqmresearch.com.au. And I'll find it all there, including the report and the free charts. Gentlemen, I've got to say, it's been a good conversation. I feel like as though we've only scratched the surface, so I think I'm going to have to come back one day.
Yeah, well, definitely. And next time, look, I'll stand in your corner, Louis, when you go against that portal that's giving you a bit of curry. I'll be at your corner, regardless of our differences in the past.
All good, mate. No worries.
Well, I can certainly say, Louis, if you're up for it, we'd love to have you back on again, because I think there's a very important set of thematics that we started to explore here that will actually benefit Australia and Australians if they understand more about how things really are.
Yeah, no, that sounds all good. I know everyone's keen to ask a few more questions on that data, and we're open to it, so happy to do that on the next round.
Terrific. Thank you very much for your time, Louis, and we'll catch up with you again down the track.
Cheers.
Thank you. So there you go, Edwin. Very interesting conversations with Louis, and a really significant meeting of the minds, in my view.
Oh, look, I think it was fabulous. And the data that is presenting, and as Lewis said, we've only just started scratching the surface. So let's see what happens, and hopefully we can get Louis back on in one of our Monday evening rants early in 2021, if we're still around, Martin, if we're still around.
Do you know something I don't? So far as I'm concerned, I'm going to be here.
No, I'm keeping my ear very close to WeChat chatter. There's a lot happening. There's a lot of stirring, but let's leave that for the next Monday. And there's a lot happening out there. And I don't think this year is going to be a slow ending. It's going to for myself and my team, it's picking up pace, but it's good. But there's a lot more, and let's looking forward to next Monday, Martin.
Yeah, well, we'll do our normal show next Monday, and we can have probably the week and all the other stuff. And I'm still waiting for that dance, Edwin, but we'll waste another day. Huh?
Yeah, I keep on telling you, salsa, cumbia, merengue. But it's just not going off on TikTok. I need to do more of that modern stuff. Either that, or I have to go learn some gymnastics and jump off buildings or some shit. I don't know. I mean, it's I'm just not getting it together. But I'll try. I'll keep on trying.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much. And look forward to the next one.
All the best, Martin.
Cheers. So there you have it. A very interesting conversation from Edwin and Louis tonight. Very important points made. And we'll be following up down the track on all of those issues. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance and the Liz May. Thanks for watching. And I'll see you again next time.